4 and 5 with a focus on resentments. Step 4 made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step 5 admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Please give a warm welcome to Tom R. from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Excuse me. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much, Desiree. And I'd like to thank Sharon for inviting me today. Again, my name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic, and it is always an honor to speak in an AA meeting, even on short notice, which I think is sometimes better for me because it doesn't give you as much time to prep and get nervous. I have a tendency to overthink things, and I could have researched and I could have written 5 pages of notes. But what I'm hoping to do today is speak more from the heart, and I do have a couple of things written down. Because I had about 12 hours to get my head screwed on straight or whatever. I'll start off with my sobriety date, which is September 9th, 2018. So that's 9/9/18, about 4 years. I got my 4-year medallion here, which I'm going to be twiddling in my hand because that's something I like to do and helps me sort of like a worry stone, you know, carry it in my pocket a lot. I have a four-year medallion, which I carry in my pocket all the time. And I have a 4-year medallion that I keep on my desk as a reminder. Like many newcomers, you know, getting those very first chips was a big deal. Getting a year was monumental. And, you know, I'm very excited to continue to work the program. And for my home group, I am actually what I call the chip chap. So I send out chips to people for anniversaries and celebrations. And it's always a pleasure to go. We have someone in my home group who always says, you know, keep on coming. That's the way it works. So my home group is Back Bay Steps, which is in the Arlington Church in Boston. That's pretty much where I started, although my very first meeting was out here in Martha's Vineyard. And so what I do is I split my time between Martha's Vineyard. We have a house in Cambridge. Prior to that, I lived in Connecticut for 20 odd years, and I'm actually a born and bred New Yorker. I have a good experience with the Beacon Group because I was fortunate enough to get involved with the Saturday morning Big Book Study Group, which was monumental for me. My sponsor and I worked the Big Book, and he had a different program with different readings. So we actually didn't start on, you know, the preface and go through the first 164, 84 pages. So doing it in an organized manner with the Beacon Group and a couple of people in this meeting was huge for me. Really helped me understand the Big Book better, understand the language. I don't think I had used a dictionary since I can't remember. And as some of you know, in that meeting, using a dictionary is par for the course. If you have a dictionary from 1935, that's even cooler. And it's helped me understand some of the wording and how the Big Book is put together. For example, you know, I'm on the beam. I always thought that was like being on a balance beam and has a whole different meaning. So I won't go into that. But big fan of the Beacon Group. I then got involved with doing some service during COVID on the Tuesday night Big Books meeting, and helped host that and newcomer liaison. My schedule changes a lot, so I'm not in that meeting as much. And I've been in this meeting a few times, mostly last summer. I will tell you that even though I'm in recovery, I still have one major addiction, which is if you live on Martha's Vineyard or spend a lot of time here, there's a good chance you're an angler or a fisherman. And so I'm up every morning at about 5. I was on the beach this morning. Great way to start my day. So I have to move my schedule around. But the great thing about AA is there are lots of meetings in Martha's Vineyard. There are lots of meetings. And with Zoom, it gives you the opportunity to catch a meeting, whether it's on the East Coast, West Coast, or international, really has made a difference. I've also been to meetings overseas, and those are always cool. I always thought when I went to the first couple of meetings that maybe they read the book differently or backwards to front or whatever. But believe it or not, no matter where you go, it's pretty much the same deal. So again, it's a pleasure to be in a meeting today. And so what I'll sort of do is start off with a little background, so you have an understanding of who I am, and then obviously I'll get to the mission at hand, which is talking on step 4 and 5 and resentments, which is definitely, that was my epiphany. So when Sharon told me what I was speaking on, and actually I had a major resentment just on, let's see, yesterday, it was perfect timing for me to be able to bring that out and think about it, because that is one of my recurring issues and has been for a number of years. So I'll get to that in a bit. So nothing really in terms of an interesting childhood. Probably the most interesting thing was when I was born, my dad was an alcoholic and he actually got sober. And that was a great thing for me and our family. He never really told me his drunk log, but I can remember as an early child, him going to meetings in New York City. He used to get the grapevine delivered to the house. And, you know, he just drank a lot of iced coffee and smoked like 4 packs of cigarettes a day. So I didn't think of anything about him not drinking. My mom, it turned out to be a daily drinker. So when I was 8, they got divorced. It doesn't surprise me now looking back at it that you have someone who's completely sober and someone who's a daily drinker. That they told me that because of the 1960s and change in political views and different things, there might have been something else going on there. So I was a child of a split house, which just sort of meant splitting time between different parents and doing different things. And probably my biggest takeaway from that, and again, going through 4 and 5 and working with a sponsor and some professional help as well, is that, you know, they often talk about, I was in class one day and the teacher was talking about a lesson plan, but I actually went to the bathroom during that lesson plan, so I must have missed it all. And so having come into AA and hearing a lot of people tell about how they were raised, and you hear other people with life lessons and their parents giving them, you know, talks about morality and being honest and all those other things, I don't seem to remember having those experiences with my parents, and that's okay. You know, they did the best they could. That's who they were. But looking back on it, I think it might have helped me later in life and might have helped me with my drinking and drugging if I had understood that. So nothing really happens early on. Just living in a split household, a little, you know, sort of less than, a little discombobulated, not like other nuclear family kind of things. And I went to prep school, and in prep school, I was actually trying to be a good guy. So I stayed away from all the, you know, long-haired hippie freaks early on. But then my senior year, there were a bunch of guys on the third floor of my dorm who used to run a fan all the time in their room. I can't figure out what they were doing up there in the middle of December that they needed to have a fan. And then eventually I recognized it was an exhaust fan, not a fan to cool you down, but an exhaust fan. And so I wound up spending a good part of my spring term up in that room learning how to smoke pot. And that was really my first foray into mind-altering substances. But it certainly definitely did the trick for me. It made me feel so relaxed and so part of, and now I'm a cool guy. And I'm not going to talk much about my pot smoking, but I was, from pretty much that point on, for the next 30, 40 years, as much of a daily pot smoker as I could get away with. And at the end, I was definitely a daily pot smoker. It was the thing that relaxed me, made me feel free. Drinking is definitely part of my story, but that was my release. And I often tell people that when I went to my first couple AA meetings, I didn't know that you needed to be completely sober. So I'd go to the meeting and I'd listen and didn't really understand what was going on. But boy, those first AA meetings were so stressful. Had to get stoned in the parking lot just to relax afterwards. And then finally someone said, you know, if you're going to be sober, you're going to be sober. And so I'm very grateful that I had that turning point where I eventually said, nope, if I'm going to try this program and work it honestly, I need to just be completely honest about it. And so since that day on September 9th, I have not had a drink or anything as a mind-altering substance, and very, very grateful for that. College, you know, was all of a sudden as if someone just let me loose in literally the Animal House movie. I joined the craziest fraternity, big rush, just crazy. I didn't know how to drink because I really hadn't been drinking beforehand. So I didn't understand that blacking out and falling asleep on someone's floor was something you really shouldn't be doing. You know, all the crazy stuff that you can do in college. And I loved it. You know, I felt part of, I loved being just out of my mind. And I took to it like a fish to water, not recognizing that it might be abnormal behavior because everybody around me was doing the exact same thing. I was saved a little bit my sophomore year because my fraternity was so crazy that we actually got thrown off campus. They said that we abused a building that was made out of cinder blocks. And I'm like, how can that be? It might have been that we threw a refrigerator off the roof or did some other silly things. And during the moment when the fraternity was really shut down, I was out of state. So I wasn't responsible for that final demise. But what I found was that I moved in with a couple of roommates because we got thrown out of campus. And one of them was a daily pot smoker and loved to drink. And the other one was a cokehead. Perfect roommates, you know, just exactly where I needed to be with the people I needed to be. So even though I wasn't in a group of 30 odd people every day doing crazy things, I was with two of my best buds, living off campus, doing what we wanted, whenever we wanted. And, you know, fortunately I did make it through college. Sort of had a little change. I got a little bored of, you know, being drunk all the time. And, you know, senior year, I sort of cleaned up a little bit. But I started playing rugby at that point. And I don't know if any of you know the sort of personality of rugby players, but there might be a few drinks after the game, you know, might be a few drinks after practice, might be some road trips, might be some shenanigans. And I fit right in there. So I sort of replaced the college fraternity for another group of 30 or 40 guys on the road, drinking 3 to 4 days a week to excess. But it was just awesome. I thrived in that environment. I loved it. Somehow I was able to hold a job and do other things that went along with it. But my behavior, I thought it had slowed down a little bit because I wasn't drinking every day as I did in college. It was really just now, let's see, after practice 2 days a week and then Saturday nights till Sunday morning. And I have some great, great stories, which I won't bore you with today. But needless to say, again, I just couldn't recognize that I was so overtaken by alcohol and that my behavior was really, really crazy. Things calmed down for a bunch of years, which was very fortunate for me. Drinking socially on weekends, still smoking a lot of pot, you know, just not seeing it. And I got into a situation at work where I was actually pretty successful early on and did well. And so my ego started to grow and grow and grow. And I think in some ways that replaced my need for alcohol and drugs because I had such an ego boost. That will come to an end and is part of my story, leading to resentments, because when people don't recognize how great you are, it's pretty easy to build a resentment against them. So married, three kids in 2 years, moved to Connecticut. I'm riding the train every day, working 10 to 12 hours a day. You know, things sort of moderate. I'm a pretty darn good parent, actually, you know, soccer coach and football coach and this, that, and the other thing. But I didn't feel at ease. So I still smoked a lot of pot and drank a little bit more than I should have on weekends. But I showed up and I did what I needed to and paid the bills. So where this sort of really goes off the rails and the resentment part, and it's the funniest thing. It's just the funniest thing. It was Christmas and I got three young kids and a lovely wife who just wants to provide. And so I have to take some empty Amazon boxes to the garage. And I look in the garage and there must be 30 other empty Amazon boxes, because we're buying presents hand over fist, right? And under the tree, it looks like a department store, which is a great thing, right? Kids go crazy, everybody's happy. But I'm like, holy cow, man, I'm busting my behind here and doing everything I can. And does anyone really thank me for all the work I've done and how I provide? And then it got me, it's like, wait a minute, now I've got to go out and shop more. And I can never find the right thing for my wife. And I got so resentful. It's like, why am I having to do this? I provide so much. There are 50 Amazon boxes in the garage right now, and I have to do more. So I really think that's such a petty thing because I didn't realize how fortunate I was. But I just sort of got in a phase for a couple of years where it's like people just don't recognize what I really do and what I provide for people. Kids turn into teenagers and they think at one point that dad's really cool. And then dad's just sort of like, can you drive me here? Can you help me do this? It's not like, dad, you're the greatest guy ever. So I'm not as excited about being around the kids because they're unruly teenagers. Still can't seem to do enough for the family. Work gets a little bit, you know, sticky. I've had some tough years because of the nature of my business. Nothing is straight up. And I was doing a really good job, but no one at work really seemed to be recognizing what a great job I was doing. I've been in the same job for over 20 years. I had been very, very successful, but no one's patting me on the back, really saying, Tom, you're doing such a great job. We really appreciate what you're doing. And so I'm just not feeling any validation. And I'm going to run ahead here where, because I've been in the Beacon Group Saturday morning and I understand that looking things up is important, I looked up a definition of resentment. And one I found is bitter indignation, having been treated unfairly, which I'm going to say is poor me. Now, again, I got the world by the tail. I'm successful. I've got a healthy family. I've got my health. Everything is going the way it should be. But it's poor me. No one really recognizes what a great guy I am. So what's going to make me feel better in my state of poor me? Well, we've all heard it before, right? Pour me a drink. And so that's where it really started to take off again, because I found that sense of ease in having a couple of drinks at night or having a lot of drinks at night, smoking a little bit more just because I needed that ease. It just sort of let me zone out and not recognize that the rest of the world didn't recognize me. A couple of years go by and I'm now living out here part of the year and commuting to New York City for like 4 or 5 day stints. And what could be better for someone who wants to be recognized than to basically check out of the family, go back to New York City and do whatever I want, wherever I want, with whoever I want, no recrimination. And my behavior really, really took off in a very bad way. I was in the wrong places, hanging out with the wrong people. You know, I had my favorite bar, which I could go into. They, you know, the minute you walk in, they pour you your drink. And it didn't recognize it at the time, but that's where I wanted to be because I felt validated. I've never met a bartender who you know, didn't think you were a great guy, especially if you tip pretty well and you don't bug them. And so my behavior just went to places I never, ever thought it would be. Now, I still held a good job and I still did all my responsibilities, but I really was turning into a person I look back on now that I had no respect for. And my behavior was just absolutely horrible. So this goes on for a little bit. And my wife is like, you know, you're really turning into pretty much of an idiot. Sharon told me I can't swear in this meeting. So I have other words I could put in there, but you're going to use idiot as a replacement for the type of person I was really turning into. And she's like, you know, I think you're doing some stuff in New York City that you shouldn't be doing. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm an angel. I'm working 12 hours and I'm going back to the hotel and I'm watching cable news and going to bed and a bunch of lies and all that sort of stuff. So finally, she calls me on it because my behavior at home is just, I'm just being an arrogant, you know, very unappreciative, distant husband. And she says, you know, I really think you need to stop drinking because, you know, your dad was an alcoholic, which of course never really, you know, occurred to me. Or, you know, remember that your mom was a daily drinker for her whole life. So maybe there's a situation where if you stop drinking, your behavior might change. And I was pretty desperate at that point. I recognized that my behavior was really on the edge and I knew my marriage was, you know, teetering in a very bad spot. And I had that sense of desperation and willingness. And so I went to a meeting here out of Martha's Vineyard, and it was a big book reading, and I had no idea what was going on. And then people would share and they'd be honest, and I'd be like, who are these people? What are they doing? I don't get it all. And fortunately, a guy pulled me aside and helped me out and gave me a big book. And he says, you know, I would recommend that you start reading this, come to meetings more often. And when you go back to Boston, find a home group. And so I did. If anyone has been to Back Bay Steps in the Arlington Church, as it should be, it's in the basement of a church. And so when I would walk down those steps into the meeting initially, I would look at my shoes so I didn't trip down the stairs. But when I got to my seat, I would continue to stare at my shoelaces for the next hour because I was so ashamed and so embarrassed. I couldn't look anyone in the eye. I couldn't look at the speaker. Didn't really know what the steps were all about. And people were extremely nice, right? They knew I was a newcomer. They helped me out. They gave me phone numbers. They invited me for coffee. I'm like, no, I'm not doing that sort of thing. And after about 6 weeks, I went to a meeting and this guy's like, let's grab a cup of coffee. And I finally said, yes. And then we had a second cup of coffee and a third cup of coffee. And I identified with this man and he listened. And he said to me at one point, you know, you're helping me as much as you think I'm helping you. And that was really the game changer for me, because I was so appreciative of the time he took and the way he listened to all my BS and all that sort of stuff. I didn't recognize why any other human being would want to do this for free for another person. And so he said, no, you're really helping me. And that's what this program is all about. And you'll get that. So I eventually stopped looking at my shoelaces and listened to the speaker and identified. And then we started going through the steps. And, you know, I am so grateful to this program. So I'm going to move ahead to the step, which is, you know, I'll just sort of run through them quickly. One was easy for me because my life was definitely out of control. Two and three, I struggled with a little bit, and I'm not going to go into that because that's not where we are. But I did have a spiritual experience, and I really relate that to page 567. If you're big book thumpers like me, I always wondered, why do they put the spiritual experience in the appendices in the back of the book? When I rewrite the book, which I will, of course, because I'm so amazing, I'm not going to put it on page 567. I'm going to put it up front. But what it really meant to me was that there had to be an overall change. I'm going to read, which it says, he finally realized that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. And that's exactly where this resentment thing comes into play. If I got a resentment, or I was fearful, or I was angry, I had to have a profound change in the way I looked at things. And that's been my spiritual experience. So my sponsor said, you know, you're going to start on your fourth step, and here's how I want you to do it. Traditional columns. And it actually wasn't that hard for me. I didn't think that I had a long laundry list, and it really wasn't too long. And I got through my fourth step, and I shared the fifth step with him. And it was told to me, one of the things you have to do is, because I had heard other people say this, is when you go into your fifth step, is there anything you might be holding back that you haven't told me so far? Because I told my sponsor a whole lot in advance. But there was one thing that I had not told him, which was integral to a lot of my other resentments and fearful items and just my whole story. And so I started off in my fifth step by telling him that last dirty little secret. And again, I'm so glad that I did, because I, you know, you get that sense of freedom and comfort and relaxation for that. So I'll just give you, you know, I gave you one idea about the resentment portion of it. And what I've been able to do in looking at these resentments I've had is work through them. And I have tools today that I did not have before. And I'm going to share a few of those because they might be helpful for you. But what I definitely recognize in going through the steps is that I had these resentments in the past, and I know for a fact that life is going to keep throwing them at me. So as a quick example, this very morning, I love to go fishing on the beach. So there's this empty spot near the beach where I could park, and there are no signs. It's a clear parking space. So I park, I go across the street, I walk my miles down the beach, I have a great time. Come back to my car. This woman comes by me on a bicycle and she says, you know, you can't park there. And I'm like, what are you talking about? There are no signs. There's no, oh, well, you know, it's conservation land and you're not supposed to park here. And I'm ahead of the conservation committee. And I'm like, well, there's no signage. And I've been doing this for years. And if I park where you want me to park, I have to add another 2 miles to my walk. She said, well, that's just the way it's going to have to be. So it would have been very easy for me to explode, to say that's not fair, to build a resentment towards this person who's only doing what she thinks is very best for the whole world, not little old Tom. And so right there and then when she rode off on her bicycle, I just sat in my car for 30 seconds and I paused. And I said, you have two choices. You can build a resentment the size of the Chinese wall, or you can not and let it go. She's just doing her job. You'll work it out. There are 1,000 places on the island to fish. Don't let it get to you, because I could just see it about to build and fester and build inside me. And I just can't do that in my life today. I can't build a resentment. I had a friend who was going to come out and visit me. So I cleared out a whole week for he and his wife to come out and join us. And I made all these plans. And at the last minute, he canceled. This is one of my very best friends. Immediately, I'm like, how could you do that? You know, I have two choices. I can either build this resentment and shut up and shut him out of my life because he slighted me, or I could call him back and say, what's really going on? Thank you, Desiree. And that's what I did. And it turns out he's got some real stuff going on in his life that he can't be here. So it's not me. It's not him. That's just the way it is. So one of the things I would suggest for a lot of people is if you find yourself in a situation where that resentment is right in front of you, and we love them, they're so great to hold on to and use as poor little me, right? Pause and ask yourself, I have two choices, right? I've learned, and one of my favorite phrases is bless them and forgive me, right? I've got to understand they've got their own situation. This woman's just telling me what she thinks is best. Okay, but forgive me, and I've got to change my behavior that I can't go down that road again. If someone's tailgating you down the street, right? You're driving on 90 and someone's behind you, as they often do in the Boston area, and you're just like, why is this person up my tailpipe? What I've learned to do is someone told me, oh, they must be delivering a baby. They must have a pregnant person in the front seat. You better pull over so they can get to the hospital on time. And that's what I do. And of course, car pulls by me and there's no pregnant person in the passenger seat, but that's okay. I've just now let it go. It's not me. So in the big book, there are a lot of examples of things that we can talk about. But really the thing that I've learned to do is to pause and ask myself, you can't hold on to this resentment. What can you do to let it go? Let that other person be who they are. You know, I've met people who are not well. And so there's the sick person's prayer, all those things that make some sense. You know, I'm going to give you two last things. One is there's something called The Four Agreements, which is a book that my sponsor gave me, which I'm a huge fan of. Some of those agreements are don't take anything personally, because again, that's a great way to build a resentment. Don't make an assumption that someone's doing something to you, and then always turn around and try to do your best. And so I've learned that if I don't make assumptions about this other person, I don't take it personally. That's a big, big help for me. The last thing I'll do is, as some people know, have seen me in a live meeting, I'm a big writer and note taker because I recognize that I have to be present in a meeting. And so again, this might be for a newcomer or anyone who goes to meetings on a regular basis, but I'm just going to share a simple page. What I do is when I go to a meeting, I immediately write down my gratitude list, because now I know I'm doing it for the day. If I understand that I get to come to a meeting, I get to pay my American Express bill, I get to show up for other people, I get to do my job, I get to help other people, then I'm going to be out of myself and be thankful and not hold a resentment. So I do a gratitude list every day. Then I write down the meeting I'm at, the speaker, and then I'll make notes. And a lot of the notes are exactly the same as a meeting 2 weeks before that. Fear, resentment, whatever I identify with the meeting, but I'm going to rewrite it down because I need that constant reminder. At the bottom, I write down what I call a willingness and action list, which is I need to be willing to come to a meeting every day. I need to be willing to reach out to another alcoholic. I do daily affirmations because, again, that was a big thing when I was feeling all those resentments, which is poor me. But if I can make a daily affirmation that I'm actually doing a pretty good job and that I am loved and I'm doing my best and I like the person I'm trying to be, then it makes me feel better about myself and not like poor little me. So I do a variety of things in my willingness and action list because I know every day I have to take action steps to stay out of the person I once was. And that's going to continue this spiritual experience, which is going to be a change in my behavior for the better to be the best person I can possibly be. You know, the steps have changed my life. There's no doubt about that. AA has changed my life. The people I've met, I do a lot of service. I do an online meeting on Wednesday morning for our group. I'm speaking next Monday at another meeting. I just love going to meetings. I love helping other people. You know, sponsorship is, you know, life-changing as well, because again, you get outside of yourself and you can try to help another person. And if you haven't been to the Saturday morning Big Book study, step study, you know, I remember when I was in it, going into the spring, and it's like, it's 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I have nothing better to do than be in an AA meeting online with a bunch of people I've never met before, but that's exactly where I needed to be. And it's made a big difference for me. So I can't say enough about the Beacon Group. I'm a big Arisa fan, if people know her. You know, I've been to conferences and continue to work the program, but it really has made a change in my life. And I'm so grateful to the program. So hopefully someone will take away something that made sense today. And I think I'll turn it back over to Desiree.